All right, everyone. If I sound a little deeper than usual, it's because I'm recovering from a cold, but I am here in London and I am talking on Skype with Christy Marks. If you want to say hi, Christy.
Hello there.
So Christy Marks, even if she's not a household name, trust me, you will know her work and probably know quite a bit of her work, actually. So just to begin with, Christy, why don't you tell us how you got started?
I'll just sort of back up and talk a little bit about how I fell into being a writer and then an animation series developer and then a computer game writer and narrative designer and so forth.
That'd be fantastic.
There certainly is an evolution there to talk about, because I certainly didn't grow up with computer games, and they kind of developed while I was already working as a writer for animation and comics. Probably unlike a lot of other people, I never actually set out to be a writer. It was something I sort of fell into by accident because I originally thought I was going to be an artist. I had artistic leanings and I loved to draw, and my mother was a frustrated artist, so she pushed me very heavily in the art direction. But the thing is that I grew up fanatically obsessed with comic books.
Mm-hmm.
And I had this major, major, major love of comic strips and comic books from the earliest age. I think, you know, even probably before I could read, I was just in love with visual storytelling and telling stories through a comic strip or through a comic book. And so I was just obsessed with them growing up. And so consequently, as a kid, I was constantly creating characters and trying to draw my own comic strips and trying to draw my own comic books. And I think by the time I was 14 or 15, I'd created something like 100 female characters.
Oh, wow.
Because of course, at the time, comics did really not offer a lot of good female role models. It was very scarce, very hard on the ground. And I was really into reading Asimov and Bradbury and, you know, and those kind of books. But there again, you rarely really found a good female protagonist, although at least Asimov did have somebody, but it was hard to find, and so consequently I was creating lots and lots of female characters and so forth. And yet, in spite of all that, it never really occurred to me that I was a writer. I kept trying to be an artist. So I turned 19 and I moved from small town Illinois to Los Angeles, which was a culture shock in of itself.
Right. Yeah.
And I started going around and showing my art, my portfolio, to these professional people who looked at it. And they did me, this one woman did me probably the biggest favor she could have done, is she looked at this and she said, "This is terrible."
Mm-hmm.
And she made me realize that, no, I was not an artist. But then I knew that I still wanted to tell stories.
Sure.
I just fundamentally, I think of myself as a storyteller, and I just like to express stories in these different media.
Mm-hmm.
And so, having moved to LA, I began to connect with a bunch of people who worked in comics. By coincidence, although comics at the time, it was basically just DC and Marvel, and there were a few alternatives and undergrounds, but they were still all really in New York, except for Roy Thomas, who was a major editor-in-chief for Marvel at the time. Mm-hmm. He decided to move to LA. So this was my break, because I was able to connect with Roy Thomas and I was able to show him some material, pitch him some material. And so I started selling stories to him. My first story was a Conan story in Savage Sword of Conan.
Mm-hmm.
Then I did some Red Sonja stories for him. And so he gave me my break that way. And then with a friend of mine, I did a Fantastic Four, little Fantastic Four story. It was, you know, what if comics. So it wasn't the regular Fantastic Four. It was this, you know, what if the Fantastic Four had different powers, you know, and we did this like short story. The same group of friends began to get into animation writing. And this was also when having someone actually write a script for animation was actually quite a new process.
Oh, really?
Because animation developed with storyboard people. Because they just, it just developed as gags, you know, and so they would they would flesh out the gags in storyboard form. And so when animation began to appear in a regular form on television, like with the Flintstones and things like that, suddenly the grind of producing that much material required bringing in people to actually write scripts. So this was all fairly new. And so one day, one of my friends said, "Oh, this company to Patty Freeling, who's an animation studio, they're looking for people who have written the Fantastic Four because they're going to do a Fantastic Four animation series. And so I said, great. And I just cold called this guy, the guy up, David DePatie, one of the two partners at the studio, you know, just cold called, got an appointment with him. Uh-huh. And just sat there and pitched myself to him and got my first animation script assignment. Uh-huh. I mean, probably not the kind of thing that can happen today.
Sure.
It would be just about impossible. But, you know, I'm sitting in this big office with this very dapper, smallish kind of a guy. He's got two gigantic standard poodles, just immense dogs. And they plonk themselves on either side of me. So I'm bookended by these two gigantic poodles. Uh-huh. And I pitch into this guy. And, you know, just on the basis of having done this one little comic book story, he was like, okay, great, you know, we'll give you a shot. And he said, do you know what an animation script looks like? And I said, no, because very honestly, who had ever seen an animation script?
Right.
So he pushes the script across the desk to me and says, okay, well, here you can, you know, read this and look at this and figure it out from this. And so that's what I did. I took home this one script and used that as a template with really not much of a clue what I was doing at all. But just trying to deconstruct what it was, you know, from looking at that and make it look like that. Uh-huh. And so that was my first animation script for this early Fantastic Four series. And so from there, I just kept working for that same studio.
Right, because you did quite a few.
Spider-Man animation series, Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends. You know, and I did a bunch of work for them. And then I got into writing for Sunbow Productions on the G.I. Joe series. Uh-huh. And then for them, I got to do my first animation series development, which was Gem and the Holograms.
Right, which I definitely saw a lot of when I was I won't say how old I was.
Yeah, I know, believe me, I run into so many people now who say, oh my God, you know, Gem was so important to me when I was a kid. And I'm thinking, yeah, I'm getting old. But it's great. You know, it's enormous. Gem has an enormous following out there. It's just really amazing and also just feels so good to me that is out there. In fact, there are now Gem Cons, and I've been to a guest of honor at a couple of Gem Cons, including one that was in the Netherlands. So I got to travel to Rotterdam and do that, which was fantastic.
Well, there have been rumblings of Gem coming back. Is there anything you can comment on as far as that goes? Or
there is nothing that I know of.
Okay.
At all. I don't think that Hasbro sees it as a big money maker. They did rerun the episodes on The Hub.
Okay.
And there was a company that brought out all of the episodes on DVD, and I did an interview for that and so forth. But and then now they're doing these. They did a license deal with a company that's making these special edition, very high-end, expensive dolls.
Okay.
Collector's edition kind of dolls. And I think maybe they were going to judge how that went, but unfortunately I haven't seen any real interest from Hasbro.
I noticed that they went and they re-upped all their trademarks, and so that's why I was curious.
Probably for the dolls.
Okay.
Because of that licensing deal. But they would be smart to do that anyway.
Uh-huh. So how long did you stay in animation before you started branching out yet again into another completely new format, basically, which was computer games?
So I started writing animation in the early 80s.
Mm-hmm.
It was probably more like 79. Uh-huh. Into the early 80s. And then a couple of things happened together, which was very interesting. I seem to have had a lot of luck in my life.
Mm.
It's hard enough to survive as a writer, and one of the reasons I would always leap at the chance to learn any new form of writing is because I just feel you need to have, as I put it, a lot of arrows in your quiver.
Yeah.
Because you never know what's going to pay off. You never know what's going to save you in a downtime or whatever.
Sure.
So come 1988, there was this Writers Guild strike.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just about to start writing for this new series of The Twilight Zone when the writer's strike hit, and it lasted for like 6 months, I think it was.
Mm-hmm.
And everything just shut down. So there was just no work. And for some reason, at the same time, the animation field imploded and there was no animation work. And so things were really desperate.
Right.
It was a very, very tough time. And it was right then that we got a call. And I say we. I was, at the time, I was married to an Australian artist named Peter Ledger, and he and I did a lot of work together as a writing and art team. Mm-hmm. And so a headhunter called Peter because there was this game company called Sierra Online,
right,
up in the Sierra Mountains, Oakhurst, mm-hmm, California, and they were looking for artists.
So just to, for a moment, to lay down the groundwork for people who don't know Sierra, if I have this right, they invented the adventure game, the format. Is that correct?
Pretty much.
Yeah.
Pretty. I don't know if they could take sole credit for it, but uh-huh, yeah, they certainly some of the very earliest pioneers in creating these kind of games.
And so their big hit was King's Quest? Was that their first hit?
King's Quest series. I think the very first thing they did was Haunted Mansion, I think it was.
Okay.
And then they branched off into the King's Quest series, and then they started creating all kinds of different adventure game series, you know, Space Quest and Heroes Quest.
And People Police Quest, and yeah. At what point were they in their development when you got on board with them?
They'd been around for a while. Uh-huh. You know, they'd been producing games for, I don't know exactly how many years, but they had certainly had quite a lot of games out at that point. So they were pretty well established by then. Mm-hmm. But they'd set themselves up in this little tiny mountain town just outside of Yosemite. Mm-hmm. And so it was always a trick for them to find people that were willing to go up there and live up there in the fairly isolated but beautiful area, mm-hmm, and work for them. So this headhunter called looking for an artist, and I said, well, are they interested in writers too by any chance? And he said, well, yeah, sure, come on up. So Peter and I went up there together to interview, and they were very, very taken with my, quote, Hollywood background, unquote. Somewhat stardust in their eyes a little bit, you know, and we ended up striking a deal to create an adventure game for them based on King Arthur mythology. Mm-hmm. And so just like that, you know, sold the house, moved up there, started working on games about which I knew absolutely nothing. This was just like a whole totally new area to me. I didn't know anything about it. And there was no guidance. There were no schools. You know, there were no books. There was nothing out there at all. Uh-huh. So I basically had to sit down and learn everything there was to learn about creating one of these games just by reading everyone's documentation, sitting there and playing their games, just playing and playing and playing, uh-huh, and playing their games, got a sense of them, going around and talking to my team, which consisted of programmers and artists and animators and my music and sound person, and finding out, you know, show me your tools, tell me what you can and can't do, tell me what the parameters are.
Right.
You know, just, I went through all of that until I had come to an understanding of what I needed to do, mm-hmm, sat down and created what would now be known as a design document. Mm-hmm. And because I saw that everybody who worked on these game designs, none of whom were, you know, game designers, because that field didn't really even exist.
Right.
They just did some random approach to it. Mm-hmm. I'm a lot more analytical. I tend to sit down and analyze all of the components and then put them together in a logical way. So I created this game design document and put it in a huge 3-ring binder, and it contained everything, the story, what all the riddles and puzzles were going to be, the whole walkthrough, maps, you know, every piece of art we would need, just all there. And it plonked that down on their desk, and their jaws just kind of fell open. And
so was this also adventure game format that you were working on?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah. And the first one was a parser-based game. Uh-huh. So that was the game where people could actually type things in.
Right.
The engine had to then analyze what they had typed in. And so that was a very particular kind of writing, because you have to handle all the different possibilities.
Right.
What can happen. And you kind of work from specific down to global. Mm-hmm. So you can have specific answers, and then you get more general, and then you have to get your sort of globally general answer when the machine finally can't figure out what the person was trying to say,
or sure,
think they're swearing or whatever. Yeah. You can write special responses for that, all that sort of stuff. So, uh-huh, so that was a lot of fun. The second game I did for them, which was Conquest of the Longbow, was based on Robin Hood, and that was when they started getting into the what they call the point and click games, mm-hmm, and so they required a whole different approach, because now it really just depended on people being able to click on the screen and having cursor icons that did different things, had different functions. And so that was yet another way of having to think about design and having to think about writing and so forth. Mm-hmm. I did lots and lots and lots of research for those games, historic research for King Arthur and for Robin Hood. And that's one of the things that people loved about the games, that had all this historical research that I put into it, a lot of details that I put into it. Mm-hmm. But also the fact that it had a good, strong narrative storyline that ran through it, meshed with the gameplay. So I've spent probably the rest of my career in games, mm-hmm. hammering away at trying to make game companies and game designers understand the need for good writing and the need for strong narrative elements and so forth. And it's been a real uphill battle.
Sure. Just a quick aside, and then we'll get back to, because I think that's definitely an interesting point to learn more about. Did you get to work with Roberta Williams much when you were at Sierra, or was she around?
She was around. She was working on her games. But yeah, I mean, I had some interaction with her. In fact, the funny story about the Robin Hood game is that after I finished the King Arthur game, the second game I was going to work on, I wanted to do something different, so I was going to base it on Greek mythology. Mm-hmm. So I'm doing my initial beginning work on that, and Roberta came up to me and said, you know, it would be really cool if we did a Robin Hood game. And the reason she said that is because at the time there were about 3 different Robin Hood movies in development.
Right, yeah.
You know, and I was aware of that, but I didn't really care very much. And I sort of blew her off. I said, I'm working on this Greek mythology thing that's of interest to me. So I didn't think about it. So a week or so goes by, and she comes up to me. She goes, I had a dream. I dreamt that you were working on a Robin Hood game. And penny dropped. And I went, you know, you're right. That's a great idea. I'll work on a Robin Hood game. So it was kind of her indirect way to say, this is what we want you to do because we're going to tie into all this movie stuff, which was a total waste of time because, you know, Hollywood puts all kinds of movies into development and half of them don't get made, or, you know, even 9 don't get made. And sure enough, I think 1 came out, and it came out before the game came out, but whatever.
Yeah.
It was still fun. I still enjoyed doing it. So
yeah, for the uninitiated, Roberta Williams was another of the first women, really, to make a name for themselves in computer gaming. I mean, she's certainly the first big name I can think of.
Oh, definitely. Well, it was Ken and Roberta Williams who founded Sierra Online, right. And they started making games out of the garage.
Right.
She was a programmer. She just came up with some ideas.
Right.
And that was how they got started originally. So, you know, that and developed into the animation games, I mean, the adventure game stuff. Uh-huh. But yeah, they were definitely pioneers.
Yeah, and but let's get back to what you were talking about before, about the importance of having good, strong narrative and story in computer games. So where did your journey take you next?
After I had completed the second game for Sierra, I made what in retrospect was a very bad decision. Cool. And I just needed to leave Sierra Online. In retrospect, I really would have done better in my career to have stayed there and done more games for them. But I didn't realize that at the time, and I didn't understand how the job of game designer was going to evolve away from what I knew. And had I stayed there, I probably could have evolved with it, but I didn't. That's also fine, because what is now considered a game designer is a very different animal from what I do.
Sure.
A couple of years ago, or 3 or 4 years ago now, a certain person in the game business decided to champion the idea of a narrative designer. Someone who was not simply a writer, because there are plenty of people who do write for games, and I certainly have done that, mm-hmm. but someone who understood the components of game design and how to design narrative into gameplay.
Sure.
Which is different than straight out writing, say, writing a cutscene or writing a dialogue that a character speaks. A narrative designer is someone who understands how to, say, anything from creating the tools that you need to implement, mm-hmm. to understanding what are all the ways you can design storytelling into a game other than, say, text or dialogue,
right.
Because it's a visual storytelling medium, and there are many other ways to tell story than through text, through words, or through speech. And a lot of games are now looking at ways to do that and looking at ways to move away from cutscenes where you take control away from the player and mesh that story information into the environments in various ways and leave it more up to the player. Some players want to have the story, some players don't. Many game designers feel nobody wants story. Nobody wants to read. I've heard this 10,000 times. Game players do not want to read. I hear this over and over and over again. There is this battle against a certain segment of the game design community that is anti-word, anti-reading, feel that no gamer really wants to be bothered with it. And what I keep trying to achieve is, yes, they do if you mesh it properly.
Right.
We mesh it with you. But anytime there's a conflict, and it's a conflict between can we get some narrative in versus can we get this gameplay, and the gameplay is always going to trump because it is foremost a game. They often let it trump at the expense of giving even the slightest bit to have that story in there, which is a shame. This is a tension that is still going on and is still a huge issue.
Well, I've noticed a lot of the text-based backstory in a lot of video games is very awkwardly put in. It's, you know, clicking gears on over books to read passages, or, you know, it's almost sort of put in as an aside, which seems like a real shame when it is actually, I think, central to the gameplay experience is being immersed in this different world and getting all that backstory, which is more than just blowing things up or, you know, whatever the means of interaction is in the game.
Now, hopefully strong narrative design can find ways to get around that and ways to express that better.
Yeah.
But it certainly is a complicated area of writing that that takes some specialized learning. And having done design work really helped me a lot and helped me to become a narrative designer as well as a straight game writer, because I've worked on console games, I've worked on MMOs, I've worked on various kinds of computer games, and now I'm currently working for Zynga, which does the big Facebook games like Cityville and Farmville and those particular things. And I'm working in the hidden object genre on a game called Hidden Chronicles. And that, so social games are yet another whole new area that is just radically different. But it's all very interesting, and I always love the new challenge. I love learning something new, trying to conquer some new area of incorporating narrative. What we call narrative, which is just another way of saying story or storytelling or what have you, but it's just come to be called that.
Right. So, after you left Sierra Online, where did life take you next?
Let's see, that was 90s. I did more animation, I did more comics. Trying to remember. I've worked on so much stuff that it's actually hard to keep track of everything, because after Gem, I did more development in animation. I did the Bucky O'Hare for Sunbow, which we did 13 half hours for that. I did the development and story editing and writing on that. And then I did Conan, did the development on that for 65 half hours. And I was the sole story editor on that one and wrote some of them, of course. And I just wrote for a bunch of different shows like Darkstalkers. I wrote for Reboot and Beast Wars, War Planets, which War Planets and Beast Wars and Reboot were all the early CG shows when they started doing computer graphics and 3D animation. So that was also interesting. And then I met and paired up with my husband, Randy Littlejohn, and he and I together as a team wrote a bunch of different animation shows, Roswell Conspiracies, X-Men Evolution, Stargate Infinity, He-Man, Biker Mice from Mars, Legend of the Dragon, Zorro Generation Z, you know, just did a bunch of different
things. So basically, things like, somebody who hasn't seen your work must have been in a coma for a good decade and a half to not manage to see any of what you've done.
Actually, too, because I wrote an episode of Babylon 5, episode of Twilight Zone, as I mentioned, Captain Power.
I remember, yeah, Captain Power, one of the first interactive television shows where you had a little gun you could point at the screen and it would shoot back at you.
Yeah, exactly. And then done Hypernauts, which was half-hour Saturday morning show that was a live-action CG combination. Uh-huh. I did all development, story editing, and some writing on that. And that was a great series that died a really unhappy death because it was being done for ABC, and then Disney bought ABC, and they just killed everything that was on the lineup so that they could put their own stuff on the show, on the air.
Right.
So that went down the tubes. So, let's see, I wrote a couple of animated TV features and also wrote some nonfiction books for an educational sort of area, a bunch of those. They're all written for sort of fifth grade level educational nonfiction books.
Mm-hmm.
So I did a whole passel of those things. That's what I meant about having a lot of different arrows in your quivers,
yeah,
because it's always something else to jump to. So if I wasn't working on a computer game or an animation thing, I could be working on a book, or I could be doing comics or whatever. I did a 12-chapter miniseries on for Wendy Pini's ElfQuest series called Wolf Rider.
Mm-hmm.
And I got a chance to work with Wendy, who's just one of my favorite people in the whole world. She's just fantastic, wonderful woman. I did my own original comic book series called The Sisterhood of Steel, which I own.
Mm-hmm.
I actually, it's a creator-owned series. Mm-hmm. I'm very happy about that. Was one of my favorite things to do, too, about warrior women. I was trying to take a look, a more realistic look at warrior women, because mm-hmm. I've been writing Red Sonja, mm-hmm. and Red Sonja runs around in this steel bikini. And
right. Yeah.
Is it both not to have sex with anybody? And I mean, it was a character that I had some beefs with, the way she had been developed as a character, as a woman. And so I thought, okay, well, I know how I would want to do it. So I sat down and I worked out how I thought an actual culture of warrior women would function, you know, how they function, and what kind of a political, religious, economic setup they would have, their relationships. And so I did a whole series based on that approach.
Mm-hmm. And so, again, this is a little bit of an aside, but when you were working in animation and comics, how many women did you tend to see or interact with? Was it a pretty male-dominated world at that time?
Mostly. In fact, I really stood out. I was unusual as the woman who wrote hard action mm-hmm. material. I did stand out in that respect. There certainly were other women writers doing it, for sure, especially on Gem. We had a number of women writers. And a number of the executives I worked with were women. You tend to run into the women a lot in the production and executive end of things. The story editors I worked with were men,
mm-hmm.
including the late, great Steve Gerber, my dear friend.
Oh, yeah.
And genius. But yeah, there were not a lot of women doing what I was doing at that time. And so it was unusual. In fact, I went to a party and the voice director for the G.I. Joe series came up to me and said, "I just want to tell you that I think you're a great writer. You write like a man."
Interesting way to make a compliment. So so a follow-on to that, then have you noticed it change throughout the course of your career? Have you seen more women get involved or take on different roles over the years?
Yes, definitely. In everything, I would say yes. Games is still a little bit tougher. There still is a problem getting women into, especially into the tech end of games.
Okay.
We need a lot more, and there are a lot of initiatives. There are a lot of women out there trying to mentor and get this area opened up and make women realize that there are great careers available and make it more open, more inclusive, and less of a boys' club. But
mm-hmm.
in games, it's still a little bit tough. There's still a nut to crack there. But mm-hmm. certainly there's work being done on it. And we get more and more women all the time, which is great. The thing I love about Zynga in particular, since we're making social games, which is for a far more mass market audience,
mm-hmm.
it's an incredibly diverse company. It's one of the most diverse companies I've ever seen or ever worked for in terms of young, old, gender, ethnicity, everything,
uh-huh.
just on, in every respect. It's just a terrific company from that point of view. I really enjoy it.
So you've worked on adventure games. You talked about the rise of social games. What other formats have you worked on? And with the understanding that game design is like the film industry, not everything that you worked on necessarily got produced or...
Oh, that's for sure. I spent... Randy, my husband, and I met at working on a Babylon 5 game.
Oh, okay.
The Sierra Online was sold and then purchased by a couple of companies, one of which did something extremely shady that got it in major trouble with the SEC, and there was this huge lawsuit, and it got sold again, and it got sold again, and, uh-huh. and so through all of these horrendous changes, and a splinter of it, a piece of it, stayed in Oakhurst, where the original Sierra Online had been, mm-hmm. and they got the rights to Babylon 5 to produce we're going to do a space combat sim game okay. based on Babylon 5 universe. And so Randy was one of the designers on that. And then they brought me aboard because I had written for Babylon 5. Mm-hmm. I knew Joe Straczynski, I'd worked with Joe on a number of things. And I knew the Hollywood end of things as well as the game end of things. And so I was brought in as a liaison translator person mm-hmm. to work between these the two ends, which were sometimes in conflict with one another. Mm-hmm. And in doing that, I ended up working with closely with Randy, and he and I ended up being the two narrative designers on the game, and that was how we ended up coming together as a couple. Uh-huh. But I almost lost track of where I was going with that. So
But the game never got all the way.
Worked on that for like 2 years or so, and because of all of the changes and the sales and everything that happened to the company, ended up killing that game. So there's like 2 years of your life that you've devoted to something right. in depth, and you've written a tremendous amount of material, and we actually filmed cutscenes for this game using the actors from Babylon 5 and costumes and the last of the sets before they were all torn down. Uh-huh. So we did all of this amazing stuff, and then they just killed the game. This happens in the video game business all the time, so it's not particularly unusual, but it's terribly painful.
Yeah.
And it's quite sudden. I mean, literally what happens is you come into work one day, they call you into a big room, and they say, okay, everything's canceled. You know, pack up. You can't take anything else except your personal stuff out the door. Uh-huh. And they scoot you out the door. I mean, that's tends to be how it happens.
Wow.
So then in 2007, I got a job at a company called Slipgate Ironworks, and they were making an MMO. So this is a massively multiplayer online game. Mm-hmm. World of Warcraft, of course, is probably the biggest and the right. best known. EverQuest was before it, and so forth. And there's Lord of the Rings one out there. There's a lot out there.
Yeah, Star Wars, Old Republic, and
you failed, But we moved up to the Bay Area to work on that uh-huh. and I spent 2.5 years working on that. I was creating the entire IP, and I was creating a transmedia IP. So I was trying to come up with something that would work for the MMO and at the same time could be spun off into animation, books, movies, what have you.
Right.
And very deliberately trying to craft it that way. And the other unusual thing about this is they wanted to make this an MMO for kids 8 to 12.
Oh, okay.
So it was actually supposed to be geared at that audience. And, I had all this animation writing background, so they figured I was just perfect for that. Mm-hmm. And so I spent 2.5 years doing that, and Randy also worked on that. And then the same thing happened. They call you into a big room and say to everybody, we're terribly sorry. It's been wonderful working with you. Please pack up your stuff and walk out the door.
And so is that what brought you to the Bay Area? Because you're still there right now. Is that correct?
Yeah, that was what brought us there. So you can spend a lot of your life working on projects that don't go anywhere, and that it can definitely be depressing.
Yeah. And so now, like you say, you're working for Zynga, and then you've also got a current comic project. Do you want to tell us about?
Yeah. This kind of comes full circle. This is interesting, too, because I mentioned I did the Hypernauts live-action TV series for mm-hmm. ABC. The ABC executive that I worked with on that very closely and became good friends with is a guy named Dan DiDio. Mm-hmm. Dan's passion in life is comics. Dan moved from ABC to becoming the vice president of DC Comics. So one day, I'm at Zynga, and one day, Dan calls me up and says, hey, how are you? And we're catching up. And he says, how would you like to do a reboot of this book called Amethyst? And I remembered Amethyst from the 80s. I had read the book when it came out at that time. It was a kind of a short-lived series.
Yeah, do you want to give like sort of a background of the main character and the general story?
Yeah, the original series dealt with a 13-year-old girl named Amy Winston who suddenly one day discovers that she belongs in this other alternate universe where she's the princess of Amethyst, and it's, you know, it was a world all built around crystals and jewels and gemstones and magic and fantasy and flying unicorns and things of that sort. So Dan proposed this to me, and I said, yes, I would love to do that. Absolutely would love to do that. Because I hadn't actually done a comic book for quite a long time at that point, and I still love comics, of course. I still read comics. I still love comics. So I've spent the past year or so doing the development on that, getting it to the point where they really liked my take, and I came up with a new take on it. I knew I didn't want to do a 13-year-old girl that ends up in a woman's body, because to me that was always the strangest part of the series.
Okay, yeah.
She was really weird. She was 13 years old on Earth, but when she went through this warp and ended up on the other side in a woman's body, but with a 13-year-old brain, and yeah, you know, it's like, to me that was always just a little bit odd.
That is odd, yes.
And so I aged her up to 17, and so I had her exiled with her mother on Earth, but she doesn't know anything about this. She doesn't know anything about her past. All she knows is that her mother gives her a very strange childhood because she's constantly training her to fight, to use swords, to use shields, to do all of this kind of stuff. And she's felt out of place and like an outsider and so forth. And then when she turns 17, her mother opens the portal, takes her back to her home world, where she discovers that, you know, yes, she is the princess of House Amethyst, and her mother is one of the two inheritors of House Amethyst, but her mother's sister, so Amy's aunt, is the one who's been holding power for the past 17 years and basically wants them dead. Sure. Because she doesn't want to share power. Because I set up these rules because I love to do world building. And I know that what distinguishes bad fantasy from good fantasy is good fantasy creates its own set of rules and sticks to them.
Right.
You know, it's its own logic, and it doesn't matter how far out or bizarre or what. Once you create those rules, you need to stick to them. I ran into a problem, in fact, when I was working on the MMO with the artist, because it was a fantasy-based MMO, magic, so forth. And so they would say to me, well, it's magic, so anything goes, right? We can just do anything. And I kept saying, no, you don't understand. That's bad. That's a bad fantasy. That, you know, just anything goes attitude is chaos. It's meaningless. But I could never seem to get that through to them.
Sure.
And I encounter that a lot also, is this not having an understanding that it is the rules that you establish, whatever they are, however far out they are, those rules are what make your world work.
Right.
And make characters work within them and give them a sense of verisimilitude. And that's my observation over all the years of doing this, is what makes the difference. It's the reason that Harry Potter doesn't show up wielding a machine gun one day.
Right.
You know, yeah, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And it's the reason, you know, Frodo doesn't suddenly engage in sex orgies with elves or something.
Right.
You have your rules.
Yeah.
So I love that kind of world building. I love to do that. And so that was, to me, the great fun of rebooting this was, okay, what am I going to establish as the new rules for this world? And I thought, okay, what would be really cool? And building upon what was done before, you know, I didn't want to ignore what the guys had done before. So building upon that, I decided I'd create a set of genetic characteristics for the various powerful houses, the House of Diamond, the House of Amethyst, Ruby, Sapphire, Emerald, the main houses, and then there's minor houses. So I did a set up a genetic characteristics that anyone who was going to hold the power that came with that house had to have these genetic characteristics. So it tended to be driven by family dynasties. So consequently, there's a lot of dynastic intrigue, a lot of family intrigue, there's power intrigues, and all of these other things that are going on in addition to into sort of the, with the standard comic book action, of course, of using magic and fighting and so forth. Mm-hmm. But, you know, Amy has to deal with learning about this new world, learning about everything about herself and her, and these powers she suddenly has that she's gained. But the power has to be shared. So anyone who has these characteristics, such as Amy, her mother, and her aunt, they now have 1/3 of the power each.
Okay.
Shared between them, because they are of that line. They have those genetic characteristics, and the power has been shared that way. And so that's why the aunt has to kill them, because she wants to have all of it. And the only way to have all is you have to eliminate the people who can hold it, because they have those characteristics. And it's the same thing with House Diamond. I'm setting up a thing there where the Lord of House Diamond holds all of the power, but he's got one son who wants to kill off his brothers so that he can be the one, and then he'll kill off his father and have the power for him. So there's all these kind of intrigues and things that are going on with it. It's a little more hard-edged, mm-hmm. Previous series. But I look around at what young women are reading and seeing these days, and you know, the big hits are Hunger Games, mm-hmm. Twilight, mm-hmm. kind of material. Those are the things that are really appealing to the current audience, and so I'm trying to tap more into that. And I'm going to drop in some romantic elements, of course, mm-hmm. gotta have that. Yeah. So I've got, let's see, there are 3 books out so far. Mm-hmm. Started numbering with number 0 because it's this weird new 52 thing that DC does, and I start with issue 0 for whatever reason. So, okay. So the first 3 issues out, which means issue number 2 just came out, and I'm just finished writing script for number 6. So I'm working 7 now.
And they're coming out once a month?
Yeah, once a month. They're also available in digital form. Uh-huh. Go to Comixology and get them, and DC's also selling them just through, Barnes & Noble and Kindle and like that as well. Yeah, a lot of people like getting them in just in the digital form, so they don't have to go out and find the paper form, but whatever.
And that way the cost of production are low and the royalties should be higher, I would hope.
Yeah, I don't think I'm going to be counting on royalties from this book, but...
One can only hope. Is there anything else that you're working on right now that you want to share with everybody? I know the comic is really the main thing.
Yeah, that's really all I have time for. DC loved what I was doing so much, they wanted me to do another book for them. But frankly, I work full-time at Zynga, mm-hmm. and it's extremely demanding work. And I barely find time to do a comic book on the side. So it was just impossible. It was simply, my husband would have divorced me. Like, no, to fit more stuff into my schedule at this point.
Well, thanks very much for meeting with us, and thank you for sharing your rich history, because you've really seen a lot of the industry evolve almost, you know, not quite from the beginning, but you've been there for such a formative part of the evolution of video games and comics, and, you know, really brought a woman's voice, I think, very much into a lot of these genres. Not the only person, but definitely one of the big players to do that. So I very much appreciate you talking to us.
Absolutely. My pleasure. And take care over there in London.